Welcome to the Gila Members Community Radio Show, Earth Matters. Earth Matters brings you in-depth coverage of local, state, and national environmental issues. We want to inform, challenge, engage, and inspire you. Three hosts alternate weekly shows to bring you a broad range of topics and expertise. Today, I'm your host, Dr. Kim McCrary, Southwest Regional Director and Staff Scientist with the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. NM Wild is a grassroots organization dedicated to protecting and restoring New Mexico's wild places through advocacy and education and ultimately legislation. Today, we're really lucky to have in the studio with us Kathy Anderson. Kathy's a leading advocate for protecting night skies, an avid amateur astronomer, and founder of the Silver City Astronomical Society. Today, we'll be talking about light pollution, the scientific evidence linking light pollution to environmental and human health problems, and what we can do to address this problem. So, Kathy, hi. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, first, I wanted to ask you, how did you come to have such a passionate interest in dark skies and astronomy, and how did you become such a strong advocate for protecting the night?
I think the astronomy story is generally a childhood thing with virtually anyone interested in looking at the stars, as it was with me. I had my first telescope in the fourth grade, did a science project on the solar system, and was fairly hooked after that. And so when anything happened, like landing on the moon, I was there with them somehow.
Well, satellite images show that all of Japan and most of the U.S. and Europe look like one big light in the night sky. And I was reading that for most people in the world, the night sky is actually just a blur, and rarely, and many of them actually have never had the opportunity to see all that you can see when the sky is dark. How many people in the world haven't seen this?
It's estimated that about two-thirds of the world population have never seen the Milky Way. At most, in major cities like Chicago, Detroit, New York, citizens can see, six or seven stars. They might see Orion on a good night.
So that's about 5 billion people on the planet.
Yeah,
that haven't.
Pretty sad.
That's incredible. So what is light pollution?
Light pollution is the projection of light upward and outward. It results in glare to the human eyes. So light pollution is a human perception thing as opposed to something that is clearly and easily measured by instruments. What we tend to do then is to measure the darkness because it's so much easier for us to get objective instrumentation data. Sky quality meters are used. There's a global standard that's established for various things. We also use sky magnitude, which is based then on how brightly you can see certain stars in a given area. But light pollution is very much a pollution. It's light, no different than air pollution, water pollution, or anything else that we're doing, including the latest, oil sand pollution, I think.
So the Silver City Astronomical Society conducted dark sky surveys
here
in Gila. And you, I understand that you were comparing stargazing here with the best sites worldwide. What did you learn?
Well, we learned that we have fairly good skies. Increasingly, we're having to go further out of town to find the same standard now that we found 4 years ago when we found it ourselves. We're finding that the sky quality meter readings in town 7 years ago, done by one of our members before we formed, were in the 21.2, 3, and 4 range. In the same areas in town, that's now around 20.3, 20.4.
And can you explain to our listeners when you say in that range what that means?
Sure. The sky quality meter system measures the amount of light in a 1 arc second square in the sky. The sky is divided up into degrees, minutes, and seconds. And an arc minute or an arc degree squared is has a various size that, from the human perspective looking up, might be a pea, for example. So these meters are capable of grasping the light and through internal algorithms in a computer chip give us a meter reading. The higher the number, the darker the sky. The lower the number, the brighter the sky. At my personal observatory out on Cottage Sand, I used to get, on a good night, 21. And now I get 20.3, 20.1, 20.0.
And what is the scale, the high and low for that scale? The low being?
Zero on up, though we tend to estimate that the perfect dark sky before humans had lights was in the 22 range.
Okay.
That's so we're really fairly good on that scale level. Again, you have to get further and further out of town now.
So you alluded to the fact that we actually have a lot of astronomers here in the region, and certainly with what you're saying, you can understand why they're attracted to the region. Now, we've been talking kind of about the heavens in an oblique sort of way, or maybe
right.
not. But so now I want to kind of relate it to terra firma. So
sure.
what is it that this area has that makes it so special, so that we actually have these darker skies, that they still exist here?
Being on the south rim of the Gila Forest, the Gila Wilderness, and the Aldo Leopold Wilderness, that's what does it. There are a couple of other things that astronomers look for. Dry, and a lack of particulate. If it's been windy and we have more desertification occurring, there's more sand in the air, astronomers don't like that. Plus, it tends to really ruin the telescope if it gets on the lens coatings. But being at a higher altitude and being dry and being near wilderness is perfect.
So Just to put this in a little bit of a historical perspective, how does Theodore Roosevelt figure into this?
He was a cowboy. Cowboys then are like cowboys today. They like to see the stars. They like to be out on the ranch in the wilderness. They like to do something to protect it in some fashion. And so I think, you know, he did a lot of good. And I wish we had more like him. Of course, I'm not sure they'd get along so well with everyone else today.
So actually, in 1905, he issued a proclamation which enlarged the Gila Forest
mm-hmm.
Reserve. So in
mm-hmm.
essence, he protected more areas, less development, less
exactly
artificial
right.
light.
Mm-hmm. Before it was gone.
Right. And then, of course, we have Aldo Leopold. You mentioned Aldo Leopold.
Absolutely.
The father of wildlife conservation.
Absolutely.
And he played a role in this as well.
He did. He liked the stars also.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Of course, all of you out there may very well know that Aldo Leopold really was responsible for creating the first wilderness in the world. And again, that is what helps us have dark skies here in not far from Silver City. I'd like to read a quote. This quote was written by Verlin Klinkenborg, who wrote The Vanishing Night. I'm sure, Kathy, you saw that article in the National Geographic magazine. I think it came out in like 2008.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly read that myself. And this is what he had to say. If humans were truly at home under the light of the moon and stars, we would go in darkness happily. The midnight world is visible to us as it is to the vast number of nocturnal species on this planet. Instead, we are diurnal creatures with eyes adapted to living in the sun's light. Yet, it's the only way to explain what we've done to the night. We've engineered it to receive us by filling it with light. This kind of engineering is no different than damming a river. Its benefits come with consequences called light pollution.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for many years, we were very concerned about light pollution, those of us that care about the heavens and learning about the origin of life and all the, you know, addressing
right.
those interesting questions. We were concerned about light pollution because we thought of astronomy, you know, the study of the heavens. And There is a growing body of scientific evidence now suggesting that light pollution also has a lot of environmental effects, in terms of the health of the environment. And it's tied to, in many instances, from the reading I've done, to circadian rhythms.
Absolutely.
So before we jump off into the world of the negative effects of light on wildlife, humans, so forth and so on, could you tell us what are circadian rhythms?
The circadian rhythm is the internal body clock. For better or for worse, whether we wish to admit it or not, we are all animals.
Hallelujah.
Homo sapiens, maybe at the top of the food chain in the animal kingdom, animalia. But at the same time, we have bodies that cycle. We cycle on a 24-hour basis. We cycle on a monthly basis. We cycle on seasonal bases. We behave in different ways depending upon whether it's morning or nighttime. We behave in different ways depending upon whether it's a full moon or not. Women behave very differently depending upon cycles that they experience biologically. And all of those are part of circadian rhythms.
And in fact, not only do animals have circadian rhythms, but so do plants and even microbes,
they
correct?
Absolutely do. The circadian rhythms of plants, for example, are so specific, and it seems we know more about this than we do ourselves, that plants very much react to different wavelengths of light for fruiting the seed put on season, whether they grow tall, whether they grow spindly, whether they grow stalky, all of that is determined by how much blue light is in the wavelength and how much red light is in the wavelength.
And since you mentioned blue light, could you talk about that a bit more?
That's a longer answer, but I'll try to keep it very short.
All right.
All light that we see has wavelengths. The blue and violet wavelengths are very short wavelengths, and our eyes do not perceive things well when blue and violet wavelength comes into the eyeball itself and affects the cones and rods. Parts of the eye shut down. It's overload, immediate sensory overload. Red wavelengths we need more of. The red wavelength helps us wake up. The blue wavelength helps us wake up. But the blue wavelength that we are producing in LED lights, for example, is incredibly harmful. The industry is scurrying, trying to deal with that. It took 2 years, 3 years to get their attention, but they realize that people won't buy LED light bulbs if they hurt their eyes. So it's coming around.
You mentioned, and because you brought it up, I'd like to go with it at this point. How is it incredibly harmful? The blue wavelength.
Well, the LED lights, which stands for light emitting diode, are produced by a very small diode that burns very warm and very bright, with predominantly blue wavelength, and the bright blue wavelength shocks people. There's a lot more glare to it because of the photopic and scotopic effects of the eye. So it makes people bounce back. They can't see around the light. They can't see to the side. It's a safety issue as well.
Safety issue.
Because if someone is standing by your front door and you have a bright LED bulb in your on your outside door light, and you're coming home, you can't see to the side of it or behind it. The same thing happens with some headlights. We see these high density. They appear blue-white, but they are not necessarily LEDs that they're coming from. But we see these high-density aftermarket headlights on the highway. And for people over 50 in particular, it shuts down the eyes and you can't see. So you couldn't see if a deer were crossing the road in front of those headlights as easily as you could standard headlights.
Well, we're going to take a break and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Earth Matters. Today we're talking with Kathy Anderson, founder of the Silver City Astronomical Society, and also a powerful advocate for protecting the night skies. Now, Kathy, we were talking about the effects of blue light in LED lights and whatnot, and how that could actually be a safety hazard. And you mentioned when you were talking about it, that when deer come on the road, you know, we may not be able to see them, and of course that could result in an accident and also the death of the deer. I wanted to jump then back to circadian rhythms, where we were talking about how most living things, in fact, have these rhythms where behavioral, mental, and physical changes are linked to the natural day and night cycle. And about 60% of invertebrates, those are the animals with no backbone, such as insects and spiders and worms, all those good little critters. And about 20% of vertebrates, those with backbones, are actually nocturnal. So this artificial light does in fact impact migration, reproduction, feeding, and in ways I think that a lot of people would be surprised and distressed to learn about. So could you talk about a few things, like, let's say, just for starters, migrating birds?
Right. I think among all of the birds, all the animals, that's probably the section most seriously impacted. Lights at night in city end up making the birds, during migration patterns, believe that there are stars in those lights. So instead of going in a direction they might normally go, they go somewhere else. Then when they get into the light itself, they become confused because, voila, it's not a star. It's a building, perhaps, reflecting light, or it's a wide field array of sports lighting. And many birds actually fly into this and die. I mean, that's just what happens.
I was reading something, excuse me, that they said about 1 million birds annually throughout North America die in collisions with lit buildings.
They do. And many are let off their migration patterns. They go someplace they shouldn't go and may not find the breeding ground they're looking for. So it impacts their ability to continue on in numbers. I don't have any data from the Audubon folks, but I've been told by them that there are some species, especially the smaller birds, the non-predator birds typically, that are reducing in numbers. They just don't get the counts that they used to get at all.
And speaking of being reduced in numbers, another problem that a nocturnal species encounters when it comes to artificial light at night has to do with the risk of being eaten. I mean, the idea of they used to get cover by darkness, and with this artificial light being added, that's an increasing problem for those animals as well.
There's an interesting study that just came out a couple of weeks ago from Federal Fish and Wildlife about salmon spawning in Puget Sound. Apparently, a new bridge was installed. The underneath side of the bridge, which has a lot of glass, is lit up. They've put tons of lights at the bridge automobile level as opposed to the little lights on the top of the bridge. And it's causing salmon to swim under the bridge to the bridge while enabling local sea lions and otters to stand in wait near a rock and then to swoop out to get the light-attracted fish.
That's where to find food.
I'm afraid so, and that's just one study. There are a lot of those sorts of studies. The insect world is continually impacted. The first study on the attraction of moths to lights was done in the 1930s, and there are huge populations of those, of course, that die. Anytime you have a light outside, all you need to see that's being impacted is to look at the base of it the next morning, and you'll know what insects are dying. If they are pollinating insects, that's not a good story.
And can you explain why?
Because we need the pollination to keep our fruits and vegetables growing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I think it's something that I know all of us at nighttime when we've been by a light, you know, we'll watch the insects as they gather and they swirl around. But in essence, what's really happening is they're becoming exhausted and they're dying. So, you know, it's probably something worthy of keeping in mind.
They are. And the overriding impact is a decrease in biodiversity. We don't have as many species as we used to have, obviously through evolutionary impacts of all sorts of things in the environment. Some species are going to die out or be impacted. But we're not seeing the discovery of yet again a new species happen in the numbers that it used to happen. We're now seeing more and more, we don't have the species anymore that we can find stories happening.
How about, I've done a bit of reading about sea turtle hatchlings. Can you tell us a bit about what's happening with them and the lights that are along the coastline?
I think the first studies done with those were in Florida. Basically, baby sea turtles hatch. They think that they're following light and sound to take them to the water. If there are bright lights on the beach elsewhere, they go to those lights. And usually somewhere between the egg hatch site and those lights, there's a house cat or something else that tends to take out the turtle, but they don't end up in the water like they should. Those studies have been going on since the 60s, and it's no longer a hypothesis. It's established science that light at night interrupts the hatching process.
Well, even something that seems as innocuous as driving on a public road, and of course we have headlights, that also has effects on frogs and toads. What about those little important critters?
They get squished.
And I also understand that it can interfere, that the light itself can interfere with their nighttime breeding choruses.
It does. Absolutely. There's no strata of animal life that's not impacted by light at night. The numbers of studies we have tend to be on species that we can first get a hold of and control within some kind of an environment where the variables are controlled. But there are studies on amphibians, fishes, insects, mammals. They've all been done, and there's a clear impact, very clear impact.
Well, can you tell us about anything having to do with how light pollution can negatively impact vegetation?
That gets back to the blue and the red wavelengths. It, depending upon the species, whether it's fruit bearing for agricultural purposes, for example, light can be a good thing if they can control it within an environment that doesn't create side glare. So shield the lights when that's done. Same thing within buildings where hydroponic growing is done or greenhouses. But all you have to do is take a look at our Siberian elms to know that there's light impact. If you compare the growth pattern of Siberian elms downtown here to ones that are done further out where there is not so much night light, you'll find the ones further out for the height and the width of the tree, more stocky, more secure, fewer dying tip branches or main branches. Here in town, they're spindly, they're gangly, they're always dropping something, and a lot of that has to do with the amount of light they get at night.
Can you explain that just a little bit more? So with that increased artificial light at mm-hmm. night, it's mm-hmm. actually changing the way the tree itself is growing.
It absolutely does. It interrupts the chlorophyll production, it interrupts the molecular structure, it interrupts everything because it's interrupting the circadian rhythm of the tree. It tends to as well make them produce more seeds or not, depending upon how much light they get. It directly impacts production of fruits and vegetables. People are just now really studying what the impacts of that are, and they're doing it in a hydroponic setting so that they can get a better sense. Because the answer to science then is to hybridize a species of, let's say, a tomato plant that's not impacted by certain wavelengths of light or certain lengths of exposure to light. Plants have to have absolute dark, just like humans have to have absolute dark in order to be healthy.
So that approach you were just describing then is kind of like finding a way for, in this case, a tomato to grow given the conditions that currently exist with artificial light rather than addressing light pollution itself.
Well, of course, that's what we in science do.
Well, there are many
chemistry,
solutions.
Modern chemistry.
Many yes. Solutions, of course, depending upon how you want to approach the problem.
Modern genetic modification in action. You've got it.
All righty. Well, and on that note, we're going to take a break and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Earth Matters. Our guest today is Kathy Anderson, founder of the Silver City Astronomical Society, an avid advocate for protecting night skies. Now, Kathy and I, before we took a station break, we were talking about the effects of light pollution on wildlife and on plants. So, you know, Kathy, it's obvious from what you've said with this growing body of evidence to back it that light pollution disrupts the natural rhythms of the web of life. And of course, as you talked about earlier, humans are a part of that web of life. In fact, we are a member of the animal kingdom, which is something we all readily seem to forget. But like other living organisms, we do have circadian rhythms. And again, these are the rhythms that respond to the natural day-night cycle. What I'd like to do now, though, is talk about how light pollution specifically affects human health. And in the research I did for this particular show, there were several things that really jumped out at me. And the first one was that in 2007, the World Health Organization declared that night shift work is a probable carcinogen. Then I came across the fact that in 2009, the American Medical Association declared light pollution a public hazard. So I'm going to throw one word out in question form to you. Why?
Well, in the studies that actually started in this area back in the 60s, we found that it had an impact. We didn't really start examining what we thought caused the impact until the last 10 years, 10 or 12 years. We knew in the 60s and 70s, for example, the night shift workers had higher cases of cancer. We knew that they had a higher obesity rates, higher diabetes rates, and higher mortality rates. And they weren't sure what the genesis of all of that was. In a study that came out in 2010, they've pretty much nailed it in rats. Now, I don't know when they're going to tear apart a human being's endocrinology system and figure out precisely that we're the same as rats. I know that a lot of studies start on lab rats that equally apply to the human physiology, but perhaps I need to make the distinction so that the scientists of us out there are aware. But in this study of 2010, it was published in the American Journal of Physiological and Endocrinology Metabolism. We found that light at night stops the production of all sorts of endocrine system matters like melatonin, cortisol, the list goes on.
And can you just for our listeners, what is it that melatonin does, for example? It's a hormone produced in the brain. What does it do?
Right. Well, when the body is ready to wake up in the morning, for example, it's because the melatonin that was produced by the brain at the beginning of the evening has been used up as light starts coming through the eyelid, and it's not just a matter of having your eyes closed. That doesn't stop it. When light starts coming through the eyelid, the brain readies for the body for waking, stops the melatonin, and voila, you're awake. Melatonin puts us to sleep. It's also a tumor growth regulator. So it has a number of other brain functions they know about. I didn't get into them as much because I don't need to go that far into the research to be fairly convinced. They have found that melatonin and cortisol in particular regulate other body functions. The adrenal gland stops producing with light. There's just all sorts of things that the body just goes, eek, a light. Let's stop this. Now we're not supposed to shut down and prepare the body for the dark phase of our circadian rhythm. And so without those lymph sorts of enzymes in our bodies, we become defenseless with various diseases. The list is getting longer. It started with breast cancer. It's now including other cancers. They're studying prostate cancer in males, child leukemia, the obesity, the depression, the diabetes. I'm convinced in reading several studies now are seriously impacted because the body's metabolism is shut down. One of the latest studies that I think came out just a week ago said there is a tendency, and this was another rat study, so let's make that clear, when in an environment with light at night, the rats become more frenetic. The brain tries to keep the body going, but because it hasn't had the benefit of all of those endocrine systems from the night, it thinks it needs food, so it eats more. And gosh, there's nothing like humans sitting on a couch watching television at 10 o'clock at night and getting
with
the munchies.
Turned on, right?
Yeah, getting the munchies for popcorn or whatever else they might want to eat. And then they go to bed and they try to sleep. But if there's light coming in the windows or the night light is on, the brain is still going to say, oh, not time to let you go to sleep. You're going to stay awake on some level. And we're going to shut down the production of all of your glands.
So again, how much light are we talking about here?
That's a good question, and that isn't really known yet. And there are studies going on right now to determine precisely how much light is required. There's an excellent film that interviews a number of scientists on that particular issue in the center of it, and it's called Lights Out. It's a Canadian film, and they include interviews with the fathers of this science, George Brainerd and others. It may only take two lumens. It may only take two lumens to shut down the endocrine system.
And
but
can
they're
you
trying
explain
to
again
determine
what a lumen is?
Right. A lumen is a measurement of light from a luminaire. And a luminaire is a light bulb, basically. And it's on most packages these days of how many watts of power that's drawn from the socket produces how many lumens in light. And I don't know the algorithm to tell you exactly how they measure the light that comes out. I can tell you that the manufacturers lowball the lumens on the package, and that virtually every luminaire produces 1,000 to 1,200 more, depending upon the density of the bulb. Not your typical 60-watt bulb, though. I'm talking about the LED bulbs. They still don't have a handle on how to measure the lumens that come out of an LED bulb, but they're working on it. One of the things that George Brainerd said in that film, the Canadian film, was if you need a light in your home at night for safety, you use a red light. So that's what I use. The red wavelength is one that soothes the brain and lessens the stoppage of various glandular productions. But any white light has too much blue-white wavelength in it, so red light's it. And the way to do those is to go to Walmart right around Christmas time and buy all the packages of those little red lights that they put out there for decorations, the kind you screw in with the small shaft.
Well, that's a good thing for all of us to know. So let's all be running out
right.
and buying those red lights, okay? So
yeah.
we're also going to be stimulating the local economy.
Right. Back to the shift work, the flight attendants, the World Health Organization, and the American Medical Association. All of those comments are advisory I'm not seeing a lot of response from physicians. Physicians don't seem to mention it to patients. I've tried working on that aspect somewhat, and it's a very difficult aspect to work on.
Do you know why they are not mentioning that to their patients?
I think scientists are cautious. I think they are very cautious, regardless of the issue. It may fly in the face of getting enough money to live. It's a capitalistic economic structure. I don't know if that's connected. Somebody should do a paper on that. But anyway, that one has not worked. There is an organization called the International Dark Skies Association, headquartered in Tucson with offices in Washington, D.C. and in Switzerland. They have been very successful in getting that medical lobby, but the doctors don't really listen much to the AMA. The AMA is what the practice of medicine should be. It's kind of like the ethics guru of the industry. It then boils down to a doctor-to-doctor decision-making process, and that's a very challenging thing. I tell people, ask your doctor, could I be overweight because I'm sleeping in light at night? What do you know about that? And if the doctor is not keeping himself informed through research, then it's a consumer decision.
Could you talk a bit more about the link between artificial light at night and breast cancer?
The indication there is fairly clear, because women in industrials, well, there's several different studies, but some of the points that have been made in these have been population specific. So industrialized countries have higher rates than rural areas, for example. Now, cautious scientists will say, wait, it could have been many, many other things. But the studies that come out and keep studying, then what else those folks are in the control group are exposed to, still keep coming back to the endocrine system. Without the melatonin as a tumor regulator, in an industrial size.
So you're saying that as they control for other factors,
right,
that could also cause breast cancer, what seems to be falling out here is that association with artificial light
right
at night.
It's not a single causal factor. That's clear. Causation is a very complex question, and there are all sorts of things that we have found that can contribute to it. But as generations of women have breast cancer, with mothers who have had breast cancer, with grandmothers who have had breast cancer, light at night has become something that has evolved into the species, much like exposure to some other toxin or something else that has created a change in the physiology of the species itself. So it becomes then very confusing for science to try to pinpoint virtually anything.
The complexities of life.
Very complex. What I can say about the breast cancer issue is that it's been studied so much now that the University of Haifa in Israel has established a center for interdisciplinary chronobiological research. And they just did that in late 2010. So that they can look at all of the variables and determine precisely a causation factor.
Okay, so they're looking at light pollution as well, you're saying.
They created the center specifically for breast cancer and light pollution, and then they're going to obviously study other things as well. But that's where they're going with that.
Now, what is the connection between artificial night light and the increased spread of disease by insects?
As we have other changes in weather, we have new trends. These trends for the Southwest, for example, are going to be more drought, more sustained wind, perhaps higher wind, and more heat, even at high elevations. So as that happens, the insects move into areas where the environment is favorable to their needs. As they do that, they take with them whatever they came with. And when they come with things like West Nile virus,
mosquitoes
with West Nile virus. I mean, mosquitoes don't have to be where there's water. They can, they can live just on blood. Yes. They can live on blood and they can go through their larva cycle in a tiny, tiny amount of water. And we're also seeing other things. I saw something the other day on a white spot tick that had been limited to the southeast continental United States. It's now moving west and has been found as far north as Maine. And its bite is particularly nasty. It causes a large lesion that many folks think looks like a melanoma. And you don't even have to be allergic to it. But it's a vector-borne disease, and here it comes, and so these things move around. Lights at night attract insects. There are very few species that don't move either on the ground or in the air because of the light. Very few of them are immune to light. Insects don't migrate. They tend to spread. They go wherever the conditions are favorable for reproduction, for the most part. They just have a seasonal...
So the artificial light is actually affecting the movement patterns of these insects.
Absolutely.
And some
right.
of these insects carry disease that
Absolutely.
Can be transmitted to humans.
Absolutely. They can also spread disease one to one another. The insects that may not carry the virus for a specific disease may be invaded by others from another territory that's moving in because that particular environment's more favorable. And so now they all have the virus. It depends. I mean, there's all sorts of ways that but it's a global issue. This is a huge global issue. They've related vector-borne illnesses now to malaria. West Nile viruses, so obviously different viruses. There are studies coming out of the CDC that I see all the time about a disease they now have found that was initially born only by insects transferring to a specific mammal. That mammal then can spread the disease. And how much of that is light pollution, I don't know. I'm sure that there is some there, but I've not seen any studies that specifically address the transference of insect to human disease based on night light. But we get it. I mean, we know that if there's more of a specific insect that carries a certain disease, humans are at higher risk. So.
Time to take a break, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the Gila Members Community Radio Show, Earth Matters, where we've been talking with Kathy Anderson about protecting the night skies and light pollution. Kathy, we left off talking about how artificial night light increases the spread of disease by insects. I'd kind of like to jump from that particular hazard to the connection between light pollution and air pollution, because this is some fairly recent research, correct?
Yes, it is. The International Dark Skies Organization published an announcement of it in December 2010 about a study done with NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and CERES, which is the Cooperative Institute for Research in Environmental Sciences, all at the University of Colorado. They determined basically that when there's light at night, it does not give the atmosphere time to recharge itself with oxygen. It creates an O3 molecule. The pollution that happens during the day from factories end up impacting oxygen molecules. The oxygen molecules, and that's a broad category of them, have a specific function of eating parts of the atmosphere, and there's no other better word for that. They eat. They are able to eradicate.
I just have this image of these little things gobbling up.
Yes, there's certain types of oxygen. Yeah, molecule. There's molecular. It's physics. It's particle physics. It's just fabulous how it happens. But irritants that form, for example, nitrogen oxide. That's a nitrate radical. At nighttime, in the dark, are broken down. When there's light, there's no breakdown. So it not only allows the pollution to go on undisturbed, it actually increases. And in the city of Los Angeles, it's doing it 6%. So the lights coming up from LA are increasing the air pollution just by virtue of lighting oxygen molecules in the night sky by 6%. Has nothing to do at all with any industrial pollution produced to produce those lights.
So what is the health insurance industry's take on light pollution?
It's an interesting question because right now, at this time, as we speak, the insurance conglomerates are surveying various organizations and individuals on the aspects of the hidden costs of light pollution. The study they're doing is based on a premise that they have decided exists, that women in developed countries are 5 times more likely to have breast cancer and that part of that is caused by light at night. So they buy it. I mean, I don't know. They must not have listened to the scientists who are cautious because they're just buying it. So it's going to cost more for health insurance premiums, I believe, to humans because they live in areas that are brightly lit. I was contacted by a group called www.insurancequotes.org to take a survey, watch their video on light at night, and give them responses about it. And it's clear that they are convinced it's something that they believe insurance companies should do, is to charge more for medical care for individuals who live in highly lit areas.
Well, given that light pollution is a growing concern, is it actually increasing in southwestern New Mexico?
It is. The lights produced at Freeport-McMoRan, for example, have exploded in the last 4 years. The portable lights that they move around to work under at night for those poor night shift workers are hugely bright. People call me and complain about them. I connect them with the mine. In some instances, things are being done and some not. The mine has, for example, retrofitted a couple of those portable arrays with shields so they don't go into someone's bedroom window. But if you drive around the mine anywhere at night, you can see the incredible pollution that's coming up. Our cities are not quite getting it. The lighting in Tucson, originally the home of the dark sky org and, of course, of many very important large telescopes that do a lot of study, like tracking asteroids, has gotten more out of control. The car lots, the sports stadiums, any place where it would clearly cost more at the outset to invest in a shielded luminaire that does not cause side glare. They're not spending the time or the money to be dark sky friendly or aware of where they cast their lights into their neighbors' homes. Silver City is trying. We have a very, very supportive mayor. We don't have a supportive town lawyer or town manager unless it can be shown clearly it's going to save a lot of money. So there's a trial project moving forward to take a look at that. I've met with the mayor and also a lighting contractor and a lighting designer because the town would like to save money with its downtown globe lights that have a vintage appeal due to our historic nature, all very important.
So changing to dark sky friendly lighting is cost effective.
It can be very cost effective. They're getting the numbers now and it's looking good. If they get something that appears vintage, like these are, but that are not metal halide as these are, and they go to an LED that is shielded on top, they can get there by baffling the sides and keeping the light at the base of retail establishments and create a safe environment for the business owner who can see if someone is casing them out and would like to come in and shoplift, for example, or rob the till. That's where it all needs to go. Our business partners out the highway don't get it. I will say the town did an admirable job with the new tractor supply shop. That lighting is great. But the county conference center new lights with the parking islands that they put in are horrible. They point straight out to the side. Also, the businesses that are owned in a chain, the gas stations, the Sonic Burgers, the Wendy out on the highway, all of those shoebox lights that are designed to point straight down are tilted up at an angle and glare into the motorist's eyes as you are coming into town. They don't want to listen. They don't want to do anything about it. And I may end up testifying in court because it's got to get done.
So what can listeners do to help protect dark skies, to minimize light pollution?
Remember that light is a tool. It's a tool that we're not using so well. When we use a screwdriver, we use it to stick it into the head of a screw. When we use a light, we should think it's a flashlight and point it at exactly what we need to light. We should shield it so that the light is funneled from the side glare down to whatever it is we want to light. If we want to light our porch, a wall light is great, but it should have a side shield on it.
And how about safety concerns? Because people do associate safety with increased lighting.
Absolutely, absolutely. If a person wants to buy an LED light, get the warm LED. If it burns at 3,000 Kelvin, that's going to cut out a lot of that blue-white. And with the shield, when you come home at night, you won't see the glare. The rods and cones in your eyes won't shut down because of the blue wavelength, and you should be able to see if someone is standing by your door. Same thing with field yard lights. Those field yard lights that are being sold at Ace Hardware are very bad. They sell mercury vapor field lights. They sell metal halide field lights. They take a lot of energy. And they're not shielded. We need to shield them. And work with your neighbor. That is the biggie. Have a polite conversation. Take cookies. Do things that will build a neighborhood and make it strong. Bright lights don't make a neighborhood strong. Strong people who use smart sense make a neighborhood strong.
And I'd also like to add to that, I think supporting efforts to protect more wild places.
Absolutely.
Is also going to provide us with dark skies so that people can learn about the heavens. So that's another way.
The International Dark Skies Org is doing that state park and national park at a time. Excuse me. They've been successful in Utah, Colorado, by replacing park lights, putting them half-cap shield domes on the side of a small brick wall on a footpath, does it, taking off the glaring sidewalls, side pack lights. And by the way, I need to add the ones about the university on the Fine Arts Theater. Those sidewall pack lights need to be shielded. I've been working on that for 4 years without any success. But shield the lights, create the wild spaces. You'll be able to see the Milky Way.
And I'd like to give a plug here, too, to tell folks to also join organizations that actually celebrate and support dark skies, like, Kathy?
The Silver City Astronomical Society, www.silverastronomy.org.
And you mentioned another international organization.
International Dark Skies Org, and the website for that is www.darksky.org.
Well, Kathy, I want to say thank you very much. I know that I've learned a lot. There is a lot to know here. Folks, please, if you do care about public health and wildlife, get involved. We've got a lot of things shaking and moving in this town, and I'm sure Kathy could use your help. And I would like to say thanks to all of you for tuning into Earth Matters, a show about earthly matters that impact us all. And Kathy, thank you very much for joining us.
You are more than welcome. Thank you.